welcome you again to the Mormon Channel and to our program, Past Impressions, which is a program that studies the history of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, with special emphasis on people, places, events, and critical issues of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I'm Brent Topp, Chair of the Department of Church History and Doctrine at Brigham Young University, and with me is our guest, Professor Brian Hauglett of the Department of Ancient Scripture at Brigham Young University. Brian, we welcome you again to talk about this critical issue of the Book of Abraham.
It's good to be with you, Brent.
Professor Hauglett is one of the best experts that we have in the church today on the Book of Abraham, its history, its significance, and also some very critical historical issues associated with it. Brian, we talked in our last episode about the historical background of the Book of Abraham, how the prophet Joseph Smith gets these Egyptian papyri and mummies. We've talked about the translation process, the publication in Times and Seasons, and ultimately how the Book of Abraham becomes a volume of scripture in the canon of the church. Let's talk about why the Book of Abraham is such a target for the critics of the church. Why is it such a firestorm to many?
Well, it actually goes back to the 60s. In the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City, they had held on to some fragments of the papyri since about the 1940s, actually. And they, through a liaison, his name was Aziz Atiya, wanted to make these materials, wanted to give actually these materials back to the church. They wanted the church to know that they had them. And so Aziz Atiya becomes a kind of a liaison between the church and the Met at the time. And they decide that yes, this does belong to the church, and therefore it's going to be returned to the church. And so there was a kind of a big thing that was put on back in 1967, and it's the 11 fragments of the Joseph Smith papyri was passed to the church. And then, of course, when they looked at it, the First Presidency or 12 or whoever looked at it, and it's all in hieratic, they looked at it and said, well, what are we going to do with this? And probably somebody said, well, where's Hugh Nibley? You know, we should maybe have him look at these things. And then once it gets into the hands of Hugh Nibley, he's the one that – he actually had to learn Egyptian, by the way. He didn't know Egyptian at that time. He was in his 50s, and he had to learn Egyptian, and he learned it very well. So he was able to go in and figure out what these were. But while this material is being looked at, there's a very clear indication that the Book of Abraham was not on any of those materials, not on any of them at all.
Like these 11 fragments.
Of these 11 fragments. You could look at it, and there was only one fragment, and it was a picture, the vignette, and that was facsimile number one. That one was there. Facsimile number two and three weren't, but facsimile number one was there. But nothing in the written stuff was in the Book of Abraham. But then some people started noticing that some of the papers that come out of 1835 had some characters on the left margin with English text next to it. And they figured out that those characters came from one of those papyri fragments. And so they automatically jumped to the conclusion that since there's a character there and there's English there, that was the translation process.
Or supposed translation. So,
that's right. Mm-hmm. That's what they argued. And they also looked at the facsimile number one, and they noticed that it actually belonged to one of the fragments. And so that it was at the beginning of this fragment. And, of course, in Abraham 1:12, I think it is, it says, I refer you to the representation at the commencement of this record. Mm-hmm. And so they automatically assumed that the record following this facsimile number one should be the Book of Abraham. Therein lies the criticism, the real, I think, crux of the what the critics are arguing there.
That it doesn't match up.
Thank you. That Egyptologists have now looked at those characters and they don't translate to what we have in the English on those papers. And so that's really the main focus there.
And let's talk about that for a second, about the criticism that these papyri, even these rolls do not date to the time of Abraham. And so that it couldn't be a book of Abraham because the time frame's all wrong. How do you address that?
Well, that one there is quite simple because for centuries in the oral tradition and then even in a written tradition, things were passed down. And then even though they were passed down, it's like when we read our scriptures, the words themselves are ancient. Mm-hmm. The paper is new, mm-hmm. that kind of a thing. And so it's the same thing with the papyri. It was just copies of copies of copies of copies, even if it said, you know, that Abraham authored these. You know, of the 5,500 manuscripts we have of the New Testament, not one of them is an original manuscript, not even one of them. From one of the original authors. And so that's just a very common thing. It's called transmission of texts, mm-hmm. and it just goes from one scribe to another. And so that's why you can have papyri that's dated to 150 BC, let's say, that's referring to Abraham who lived back 2000 BC. Mm-hmm. That's why you can do that.
Okay. You're listening to Past Impressions. I'm Brent Topp, your host, and with me today is Professor Brian Howglad of the Department of Ancient Scripture at Brigham Young University. We're talking about the criticisms of the Book of Abraham and going back to the 1960s and the fragments that came to the church from the Chicago Metropolitan Museum. Brian, you've explained that. Well, how do we, as Latter-day Saints, how do Latter-day Saint scholars respond to those criticisms to say, well, this is just a more recent funerary text, or this is not the Book of Abraham? That seems to be the big issue right now. From your research, from your understanding, how do we respond to those critics?
Well, it's simply that the manuscripts that we have right now, since they're not the original manuscripts, they're all paragraphed. I mean, if you were to look at the Book of Mormon manuscripts, and we have a third of those, originally dictated manuscripts, it's just one long sentence, mm-hmm. no punctuation, nothing to no paragraphing or anything. But all of these manuscripts, they're paragraphed, there's punctuation in them, and it looks like, to me anyway, that they're well beyond the dictation phase. And so just the fact that those have those characters in it doesn't necessarily mean that Joseph Smith was translating mm-hmm. His originally dictated material from those characters.
In fact, I think you make a really strong point about, while we don't know exactly what those were, but they could have been code for something else.
Who knows?
They could have even been doodles, as far as we know.
They could have been paragraph markers. Mm-hmm. We really just don't know exactly what they were doing with those. But the fact is, the material that we're looking at now is much different than what Joseph Smith, that raw material that he gets when he gets a revelation and just gets put down for that very first time. It just looks different than that to me. And so I don't see that as an indication of Joseph's translation. He never really translates that way anyway.
Yeah,
he didn't even do the Book of Mormon that way.
Yeah, so the critics would be arguing from silence on that by saying, well, this doesn't match up, when in reality we never have said it does.
That's right. That's right. We would never say that the papyri that comes from the Metropolitan Museum in New York had any Book of Abraham in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so, but of course the critics are going to bounce back and forth on that one, but still it's a very, to me, a common sense response, you know, mm-hmm. to say that, yeah, this is just different material here. And the fact that you have three copies of the same chapter with the same exact characters on it tells me that it wasn't translation, it was something else going on.
Yeah. And the 11 fragments we have no idea where they come from on the papyri rolls, do we?
Well, we have a little bit of an idea on some of that because there's a papyri roll in Paris. It's called the Louvre 3284, and it's very much like what we get two of our fragments, and that has a whole thing. And that's what Nibley worked on. Mm-hmm. He worked on that, and he was actually able to go through and look at the papyri, and he did translations. And so he could even see where it kind of fit in the role there. Uh-huh. So,
but as far as knowing exactly where the Book of Abraham fits within all of that, we just don't have any record of that at all.
No, we don't. We have no record of it. We know from contemporary accounts. For instance, I think it was John Whitmer who said that Joseph Smith received the Book of Abraham through the revelations of Jesus Christ. And even Warren Parris, one of the scribes, said something similar. I sat by Joseph Smith as he dictated to me by the inspiration of heaven. And so we know that there's revelation, that there's inspiration going on there. But we don't have – I don't think these papers that we have now are representative of that particular process that he had.
You know, there's an interesting parallel in the Doctrine and Covenants. Section 7 of the Doctrine and Covenants is a translation of the record of John. And we know that Joseph Smith never had a tangible record of John in his hands, but he is doing a translation from a document that he sees in vision.
That's right.
Could that have been some of the translation process as well?
Absolutely. In fact, you hit onto one of the three theories, I think, that are kind of prominent right now. Theory number one is there was an actual Book of Abraham. Mm-hmm. It was on papyri. It was on a long roll, and Joseph Smith translated it. Number two is that there was a text there, all right, but it was more of a catalyst for Joseph Smith. It was a catalyst, and he received revelation.
Mm-hmm.
And number three is there was no ever any Book of Abraham
on the
scrolls
at all.
Yeah, number two was more of like a corrupted text that maybe it was from Abraham, but it was corrupted.
Uh-huh.
Number three, though, there was no text. Mm-hmm. There was nothing. He just gets it in vision, and that's not
out of the realm of possibility.
Exactly.
Either.
Yeah.
Okay. What do you do, Brian? I'm serving as a stake president right now, and sometimes I get people that have doctrinal questions or questions on the history of the church and ask me, well, what do you do with the fact that this Book of Abraham isn't what Joseph Smith purports it to be? How do you, from a scholarly standpoint and as a man of faith, respond to people's doubting the veracity of the Book of Abraham?
Well, I try to encourage them to look at both sides. There's plenty out there that gives the critic's point of view. And sometimes that just bowls people over and they never really consider the other side of the equation. They really never look at the whole picture there. And so they're only really getting one side. And to me, that's a problem. You need to look at the other side. We've got material out there now that kind of helped. I think it helps explain what's going on from our perspective on these documents. We're never going to get it perfect, I don't think, because these you know, we're 100 and, you know,
70, 80 years later.
That's right. And so we're never going to get it perfect. But there are explanations that a reasonable person can look at and go, yes, that makes sense to me as well, and not just buy into what just the critics are saying. So get both sides.
Today on Past Impressions, we're speaking with Professor Brian Hauglid about the Book of Abraham. Brian, we've talked about how we respond to many of the criticisms concerning the Book of Abraham. Let's talk about those criticisms with regards to the papyri themselves, and we've talked a little bit about the fragments. How do you explain those things? And we've talked about coming at it from both a scholarly and a faithful standpoint. How do you do that?
Well, with the papyri, I look at it from the perspective of that, number one, the Egyptologists don't even know much about some of what we're getting with this papyri. For instance, the facsimiles, they don't ever really spend any time with that. We do because we have them.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have Egyptologists, LDS Egyptologists, such as John Gee or Michael Rhodes or somebody like that, that's looking at these things and writing about that. There's not a whole lot really that other Egyptologists are that concerned about, and with questions that the critics bring up, such as why do we have the facsimile here with Abraham on? Do any other facsimiles have Abraham on them out there? Well, maybe it's a unique one. And so John Gee has done research on that and found that just about every single one of the facsimiles that might have looked something like Abraham's are unique to them.
Mm-hmm.
Unique, very unique. For instance, most of the facsimile number ones are dealing with embalming, funerary, like you said
that's
earlier.
That's one of the criticisms.
That's right. Whereas this one here, you've got Abraham, and he's got his two arms up and a leg up, which indicates that he's alive. Mm-hmm. And are there any other living ones out there? And the questions come, did the Egyptians do human sacrifice? And we get that in Abraham 1 as well. Well, John Gee has gone through and studied that. Most Egyptologists don't because it's not of interest to them, but John Gee has looked at it and said, yes, the Egyptians did do human sacrifices. They did do those kinds of things. And so those kinds of criticisms can be, I think, addressed by looking at the question, and it's going to be from a new perspective, perhaps. Perhaps the Egyptologists haven't really dealt with that
before.
Well,
I think a lot of times they close the door shut on it because they think they know everything there is to know about it. We've studied this for years, and so we're not even going to allow for another possibility.
That's right. And so John Gee becomes really a great Egyptologist because he's going into stuff nobody else is
exactly
doing.
Exactly right, yeah.
And writing and publishing about it. And he's not even using a church. You know, he's not really doing it. It's actually a great professional thing for him. But the point here is that when we look at this material, we're looking at it from new perspectives because it came from Revelation. Mm-hmm. And we're looking at it entirely in a new light here. And so we're going to go down different roads. We're going to come up with different issues and conclusions that the critics who do rely on what the Egyptologists say. You see what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
You get that.
So you can pick and choose which scholar you want to use.
That's right. That's right.
And so it's the same kind of thing that we see with archaeology, is that you can have archaeologists claiming different things, looking at the exact same evidence, but coming at it from different training, different eyes, and those types of things. Any other issues with regards to the papyri themselves that we ought to address?
Well, scholars right now are looking at, you know, how long the roll might have been, how thick it was.
And why would that matter?
Well,
why does that matter in regards to the criticisms?
Well, if the eyewitnesses were saying that the Book of Abraham was on a long roll, mm-hmm. then we'd want to look at the question, well, does that mean then that the fragments that we have come from a much longer roll? And can we find evidence of that? Are there ways for us to determine that? And there's a German scholar who actually came up with the formula for figuring out how long a roll was by looking at the windings.
Hmm.
How many times it goes around, and then comparing it to another roll that's more complete.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're able to kind of look at that. And that's a question that's actually being looked at right now.
And it is interesting, as I've read your piece on that, what do we anticipate, or what do we think that the Nauvoo papyri rolls could be in length? What is the possibility?
Well, the critics will say it was real short, of course.
Yeah.
That's what they want to say.
Well, because you want to narrow it down to 11 fragments.
That's right.
And say it comes within a foot or two.
That's right.
And yet with this other research, what is the possibility of how long could the roll have been?
That's right. Well, now we're looking at it and kind of putting in these formulas and looking at it could be 14, 15, 16 feet long. That's pretty
mm-hmm.
long, actually.
Yeah.
And those hieratic characters, if you get those all crammed in there, you could mm-hmm. get a lot of information out of those.
Yeah. And so
very compact.
The implication of that, as I understand it, for a Latter-day Saint would be to say, hey, those fragments maybe represent a very, very, very small portion of what Joseph Smith had
That's
in his
right.
possession.
That's
so
right.
Even if we are going to the text coming from papyri as a direct translation, we're still saying you're only looking at one very small snippet.
That's right.
It'd be like making an assumption on Mesoamerica and the Book of Mormon peoples of all of North and South America when you only look at one square foot.
That's right. That's right. And you need more, don't you? You need
yeah.
a little bit bigger picture to see what's going on there. And so that is a very good way to put it.
Or like when I've been on an archaeological dig before, and I'm digging in a grid that was probably outside the city walls, and I find nothing in it, I would be wrong to make a conclusion to say there was no inhabitants here, because in the grid 5 feet away, there could be something incredible there.
That's right. That's right.
I'm Brent Topp, your host of Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel, and today we're speaking with Professor Brian Hauglid, a scholar on the Book of Abraham and has done a great deal of work, a professor in the Department of Ancient Scripture. Well, Brian, we've talked a great deal about the origins of the Book of Abraham. We've talked about the critics' concerns and criticisms against the text. What is the you have probably done as much work on this as just about anyone else in the church. What does it all mean to you? How do we bring it all to an end now of what have you learned about the manuscripts? How do you reconcile the criticisms with your faith? Bring your scholarship and your spirituality together on this as we bring it to a close.
I've been working on this stuff for many years now, since probably 2005 that I've really started looking at this material and trying to grapple with some of the issues that you and I have talked about. And it's become very clear to me that the deeper that you get into it, okay, you can see the divine prophethood of Joseph Smith. There's mm-hmm. just no question about it, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. I see the remnants of what we have from that period, as the snippets, I guess, as we might say, the little cuts of picture here and there, as just little fragments of things that went on at that time. But it by no means takes away from me anyway the fact that Joseph Smith received a revelation in which he received a book of Abraham. And following that, yeah, there's things that go on. The way I reconcile it is there was interest in Egyptian. Mm-hmm. There was interest in those kinds of things. So I see the manuscripts and the papyri kind of coming together on that. Perhaps the scribes were trying to figure out Egyptian stuff. But for me, the revelation had already come. Then you get this Egyptian stuff going on with the prophet and some of the earlier brethren there and their questions and those kinds of things. But that becomes more of a secular thing for
me. Exactly. Yeah.
More of a secular pursuit. So I see that as I see the prophet Joe Smith still being just as much of a prophet as he was from the very first time that he became the prophet. Mm-hmm. And that was inspiring for me, actually, to see that, because I needed to kind of separate that human endeavor mm-hmm. that was so obviously going on back in those days, and separate that from the prophetic divine revelation that Joe Smith had. And that tells me that we're all kind of like that. Mm-hmm. You know, we all have these inspirational moments, but yet we have our human moments too. Mm-hmm. And
well, this has been a life's work for you in so many ways, and kind of your magnum opus on that. Why don't you tell us about publications in your book and things that have come as a direct result of you dealing with these issues?
Well, John Gee at Neil A. Maxwell Institute for Religious Scholarship and I are co-editors of a series called Studies in the Book of Abraham. And we started it back in 2000, maybe even earlier than that. But our first publication was Traditions About the Early Life of Abraham. And that's where we look at old traditions from mm-hmm. Judaism and Islam and Christianity. And we look at that in terms of, does any of this kind of correlate with what we're seeing in Abraham 1 mm-hmm. and Abraham 3, especially those chapters that Genesis mm-hmm. doesn't have? And you'd be surprised. We found some interesting things there, which tells me that we're not dealing with just a modern 19th century text. We're, uh-huh. we're dealing with an old text here, an ancient mm-hmm. text. And so, yes. You look like you need to ask a question.
I'm just amazed at it, the parallel it is to the Book of Mormon, and how, you remember Nibley talked about
yes.
it would be like someone writing a history on ancient Tibet.
That's right.
With what they had known. And I just think that Abraham's the same kind of thing.
It's exactly the same thing. We've had several more volumes come out. Michael Rhodes has done two volumes on the papyri. He's got them all translated. Michael Rhodes has also got a complete translation of facsimile number 2. And so that's all in our series there and on Michael's website. The most recent book, I've traced the text of the Book of Abraham from its earliest manuscript stage all the way to now, and what all happened with it. And what I have found is that the Book of Abraham is from the day that it was revealed till now, that we pretty much have what the Lord revealed to. I mean, of course, it's going to change. We've got changes in the Book of Mormon, you know, for the little grammatical
things.
Sure, editorial.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to get some of that. That's going to happen. But the revelation is still there. Uh-huh. And it's very inspiring to see that, because I had to look at everything. I looked at all the editions, looked at all the manuscripts, and it's just a marvel to me to see how it's so preserved.
I find it fascinating that critics, both of the Book of Abraham, but Mormonism in general, don't always want to acknowledge that there are men and women of incredible scholarship ability that have dealt with these issues for a long time.
Yes.
It's not like the critics are the only ones that have ever thought about any of these things.
Oh, no.
And I find it fascinating. And as we have spent this episode talking about the Book of Abraham, that it holds up under scrutiny.
Absolutely.
Just like the Book of Mormon holds up. And in fact, as you said a few minutes ago, the more we scrutinize it, the more faithful it becomes as opposed to the other way around. So what would you say to your BYU students, or what do you say to a young adult or a teenager or a new member of the church that says, well, I've been told that the Book of Abraham was just made up?
Well, I would say that you haven't felt the spirit of the Book of Abraham
yet. Exactly.
You need to hear the voice of the Lord in the Book of Abraham just like you do in the other scriptures, and then you won't say that.
Yeah, and all the intellectual arguments can be addressed. There are good, reasonable responses to all the criticisms, but the bottom line is it still has to come down to that spiritual experience. Well, you know, through your years of research, Brian, you have become a friend with Abraham. How has he blessed your life?
Well, it's amazing to me. I've thought about Abraham actually since I was a young man. I was a Catholic, and before I joined the church, I even had just feelings. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. One day I was talking to Elder Marlon K. Jansen just a little bit about this, and he looked at me and said, Brother Hauglid, the Lord has raised you up for this particular project. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I guess he has, in a sense. It's kind of like Bob Matthews.
Yep.
He was raised up to do what he did. And I feel like maybe that's my little part there.
I believe that,
and
too.
So that's kind of how I feel about
it
anyway.
And all of us that are descendants of Father Abraham are beneficiaries of your great work. So thank you, Professor Hauglid, not only for your lifetime work, but also for being our guest today on Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel.
Thanks, Brent. It was a pleasure to be with you.
I'm Brent Topp, your host, and saying we hope you will join us for future episodes of Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel.